episode of Interpreting India. From geopolitical complexities to economic uncertainties, India faces critical challenges in its quest for a more prominent role on the world stage. This season, we at Carnegie India continue to bring voices from India and around the world to examine the role of technology, the economy, and international security in shaping India's future. My name is Tejas Bhardwaj, and I will be the host for this episode of Interpreting India. In this new space age, countries and private companies together are aiming to establish long-term presence on celestial bodies such as Moon and Mars. To facilitate this long-term presence, they are currently studying the feasibility of using resources found on these celestial bodies. Further, there are also ambitious plans to extract potentially valuable resources from the Moon and asteroids and bring them back to Earth for utilization. In this context, this episode will talk about space resource activities and governance, focusing on its legal aspects as well as multilateral initiatives that are currently underway to discuss their governance, exploring the possible role of active spacefaring countries such as India in such initiatives. Joining us today to discuss this interesting topic is Professor Stephen Freeland. While he needs no introduction in the space sector, Professor Freeland is an Emeritus Professor of International Law at Western Sydney University and a professorial fellow at Bond University. He also holds eminent positions at various other universities and institutes in Copenhagen, Vienna, Toulouse, Hong Kong, Montreal, Kuala Lumpur, Vancouver, Mumbai, and London. Previously, he has had a 20-year career as an international commercial lawyer and as an investment banker. He is a member of the Australian Space Agency Advisory Board and has been an advisor to the Australian, New Zealand, Norwegian and several other governments on issues relating to national space legislative frameworks and policy. He is an honorary director of the International Institute of Space Law, a member of the Advisory Board of the Space Generation Advisory Council and a member of the Space Law Committee of the International Law Association. In 2022, he was presented with a Lifetime Achievement Award by the International Institute of Space Law, which is the highest accolade awarded by that institution. Notably, in June 2021, he was appointed by the United Nations Committee on Peaceful Uses of Outer Space as the Vice Chair of the Working Group on Legal Aspects of Space Resource Activities. Professor Freeland, welcome to Interpreting India.
Oh, thank you, Tejas. It's a pleasure to be here, and thank you for reaching out. And it's very timely that we talk about this topic.
Yeah, thank you, Professor. With that being said, Professor, let us please move to the first question of the session. What are space resources and space resource activities? And why are countries looking to acquire these resources? What is the future scope, opportunities, challenges, and concerns associated with these activities?
Well, that's a very comprehensive question. Thank you so much for asking. And many of those questions are currently being considered by the 102 member states of the United Nations Committee on the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space. You very kindly mentioned in the introduction that I have the honour of co-chairing the working group of those 102 countries on a five-year mandate to look at some of these questions. Our working group is called the Working Group on Legal Aspects of Space Resource Activities. So one of the questions you asked is, what is space resource activities? And that's an issue that actually is part of the discussion, because there's differing views about what are space resources. Obviously, there's been a lot of discussion about, if you like, the mineral aspects. If we talk about the moon, the mineral aspects of the moon, including helium-3 and other things, there's been a lot of discussion about water as a resource. But then other ideas come into the notion of resources more generally, that is spectrum, that is clear skies, that is areas of strategic interest, etc., etc. And so part of the discussion is, what are space resource activities for the purposes of our working group in terms of governance? Putting that aside, because most people would agree that at least the idea of accessing water or accessing minerals would fall within that. Why is that of interest? It's a great question, Tejas. We've been excited by the idea, humanity has been excited by the idea of exploiting these resources for decades. As a result of an assessment, an examination of the 300 kilograms of moon rock that the Apollo missions brought back, humanity already thought in the 1970s that it may be of great interest to move forward in our activities, again, just focusing on the moon. And indeed, out of that excitement, we developed more specific international space law in the form of what we know as the Moon Agreement. The Moon Agreement is a treaty that came through the COPOS process that supplements the foundational outer space treaty, but deals specifically with the idea of what is referred to there as exploiting space resources. India, as you know, is a signatory to that treaty. Australia, where my state of nationality is a state party. So already in the 70s, there was this notion of, well, perhaps we could exploit the resources. That's really interesting, but of course the legal framework of space means that it's non-territorial. Indeed, it's an area that we all have a stake in. Many refer to it as the global commons, although there are a number of countries that don't like the use of that term. But the idea that space is beyond national jurisdiction, an area that we all have a stake in, and therefore the governing framework's international law, the idea of exploiting these resources, therefore, if that were to ever happen, should be governed by international law. And of course, as you know, there are parallels, similarities, although it's not identical, with the idea of exploiting the mineral resources in the deep seabed. And that there is, as you know, a UN body based in Jamaica, the International Tribunal for the Law of the Sea, that is already looking at applications to exploit those minerals. So there is a regime set up for that. Ultimately, if states want to move forward in space resource activities, whatever that may look like and whatever that may involve, then it would be imperative on us to form a governance structure which is already consistent with the existing law, because the existing law has got a lot to say about this already, but would cover other specifics, because in the end, what we need to avoid is that in any activity in space, and let us say again, focusing on the moon, any space resource activity on the moon, where you've got different countries and their corporations, different alliances, perhaps engaged in a similar activity in a close geographic location, in a hazardous environment, what we must avoid is that they are operating under different rules, because that is the makings of misunderstandings and miscalculations. And so it's important, given that it seems that many states want to proceed with some form of these activities. And as I said, we don't even know what that looks like really. But if they want to move forward in that, it has, of course, potential for great benefits, but there are certainly risks associated with it. And so we need to find a structure, ideally based on a multilateral arrangement, in whatever way, shape, or form, that will allow for those activities to go forward with the maximum benefits, the minimizing of risks. And that's where the working group is an integral part. We listen to all the voices. There are many inputs from national laws, from alliances and accords, from civil society. But in the end, in my personal opinion, we need to have an arrangement where 102 countries and every stakeholder that they represent are on a common rule book, whatever those rules look like, so so that we minimize the risks of conflict. So we are moving forward. It's a very complex area. It's a very political area. It's a very strategic area. But there are, if you believe what many people say, some extraordinary benefits for humankind if this is done in a safe, sustainable, and peaceful way.
Thank you, Professor. That was interesting. You did make points on the opportunities and the challenges with regards to having a common framework. In that sense, what is the relevance and importance of existing norms that are present in international space law, such as the Outer Space Treaty and the Moon Agreement, to govern these activities in a responsible, peaceful, and sustainable manner?
Well, that's a great question. And as I said in my first response, there's already a lot of existing law. For those of your listeners who perhaps aren't so familiar, we have quite a substantial body of international law in the form initially of 5 multilateral treaties. The first one of those is the what you refer to as the Outer Space Treaty of 1967. It contains foundational principles upon which every activity in space, all aspects of the exploration and use of space, not just space resource activities, but all other activities, should be based. And those foundational principles revolve around peaceful uses of space, revolve around cooperation, revolve around states taking due regard of the interests of others, revolve around states having responsibility, not only for their own actions, but for the actions of private sector actors who are within their jurisdiction, revolve around a liability regime if things go wrong, revolve around the idea that we essentially need to cooperate. And so existing law has a lot to say generally. The Outer Space Treaty doesn't make express reference to the specific idea of space resource activities, but it's still very relevant, and it's ratified by, I think it's now 114 states parties, so of course virtually every spacefaring nation plus many others. You also mentioned the 5th of those treaties, the Moon Agreement, which was in 1979, which was, as I mentioned before, the culmination of discussions emanating from that enthusiasm based on what we saw in the moon rock and the success of the Apollo mission. The Moon Agreement, as many people are aware, has far fewer states that have ratified it. At the moment now, it is 17 states parties plus a number of signatories, of which India is one of the signatories. The Moon Agreement, therefore, represents international law, but its rights and obligations are only binding on a relatively small number of countries. Yet it also contains some really, really important and interesting ideas about the specifics of any future space resource activities. And although it doesn't represent international law beyond the states parties who are bound to it, there are many interesting ideas there about adding in environmental considerations, even making more certain that the moon and other celestial bodies are not used in any military way. The Outer Space Treaty says that already. The Moon Agreement even reinforces that more, and it even makes reference to denying the threat or use of force, so bringing in principles from the UN Charter. The Moon Agreement also says that at some point, if the activities contemplated under that treaty, which really talk about exploitation, again, we now talk about space resource activities, but in the Moon Agreement, it was talking about exploiting resources. The Moon Agreement makes reference to the fact that when those exploitation activities are to become feasible, then the states parties would put a regime together. Now, remembering there's only 17 states parties, None of them perhaps represent the countries at the absolute forefront of the technology, although many of those countries, like Australia, will be partners in lunar projects of various sorts. So in a sense, the regime contemplated by the Moon Agreement is still, if you like, there and a possibility for the 17 states parties. But since then, and particularly in more recent years, the discussion has become far more concentrated, culminating in the work now in the multilateral level. But there are also many other conversations taking place at both the national, bilateral, regional, and civil society levels. But we now have a much broader discussion, so that in the end, if the states parties believe that we should put together some form of governance framework to complement the already existing law, which already is very relevant, then that will presumably be done at this multilateral level. But it's not as if we have a blank piece of paper. There are many interesting, important ideas that many clever people at all levels have already thought about. And so those ideas are there, in a sense, on the table for the multilateral framework at the appropriate time to say, well, that's not a bad idea. Why don't we include that in the idea of a multilateral governance framework? But we still have a long way to go. But certainly progress is being made in a way that is systematic, as much as possible, inclusive and transparent and open, given, of course, we're operating under the constraints of an intergovernment process. So we have to respect the views of states parties within COPOS. But there's so much technical and industry and economic and cultural and indigenous and scientific perspectives, all of which will be relevant if in the end some form of initially high-level principles and maybe something in the future, who knows, is decided upon by the states parties.
Thank you, Professor, for that. We talked about initiatives and frameworks that are within the UN. But right now, we're also witnessing countries sign principles, such as the Artemis Accords. And some have also adopted legislation and policies to facilitate commercial extraction and sale of these resources. In this context, how are countries looking to govern space resource activities? And what would be the role of government, private sector, and industry in this process?
Well, again, your question is a great question because it highlights the complexity of the whole. You know, there are many, many layers, many different voices. Yes, as I've mentioned, the multilateral process is proceeding. Now, many say that the multilateral process is too slow. Well, it is what it is, because of the nature of what multilateralism is. We need to have a process where every stakeholder state, indeed every state, has the opportunity to contribute, to have a say in what any ultimate high-level principles or whatever may look like. You would assume that each of those states, as they consider their inputs to the multilateral process, will themselves be considering the multiple voices within their own jurisdiction. So already through the state statements and contributions and inputs, there is a bringing together of different views. But of course, states want to encourage. So certain states certainly want to encourage these forms of activity. So as you've mentioned, a number of states, for example, have passed national laws which encourage and purport under their national system to give certain rights to entities within their jurisdiction that wish to engage in some form of exploitation and perhaps commercial exploitation of space resources in the future. And it's interesting that, for example, the United States, which was the first of those countries to do that in 2015, and by doing that really galvanized then the need for a discussion at the multilateral level as well. The United States legislation, which purports to give US entities certain rights if they engage in these activities, has these interesting words right at the end, subject to the United States' international obligations. So it's clear that, of course, states are paving the way within their own systems so that if these activities ever come to fruition, they already have a national framework that works. But they're making it, in a sense, clear that we need to understand that the international framework really sets those rules. You mentioned the Artemis Accords. Artemis Accords, as you know, is a set of bilateral, non-binding, if you like, arrangements between NASA and the space agencies now of, I believe, 35 or 36 other countries. And it's about not just space resource activities, but broader activities in terms of activities, for example, on the moon. But clearly it also encompasses space resource activities. And that has a whole set of principles. It's arrangements between those signatory states through their space agency. But even it, quite rightly, recognizes, firstly, the centrality of the Outer Space Treaty, and secondly, says that obviously any discussion on these should be done in conjunction with the multilateral processes at COPOS and perhaps at any other forum, but certainly therefore envisaging that the working group, of which I have the honour to co-chair, is an integral part. So, but Artemis Accords, for example, also has some really interesting ideas. I mentioned the Moon Agreement does. The Artemis Accords does as well. Again, we're not starting with a blank piece of paper on ideas about how any possible future framework might look. Artemis has many interesting ideas, really detailed inputs. So they will also be inputs to the international discussion, as will the Moon Agreement, as will inputs from national lords, as will inputs from the private sector, as will inputs from other bilateral and regional and minilateral alliances between other countries. So it's a positive that there are all those conversations going on, because in the end, it will, in my opinion, be necessary to have a multilateral understanding. But that multilateral understanding will have the benefit of seeing a whole range of different perspectives, ideas, suggestions, recommendations, provisions about the conduct of these activities. And therefore, the multilateral process will have the benefit of being able to consider a broad range of things, because whatever the multilateral process comes up with, it has to be appropriate, not just for 1 or 2 or 5 years, but for the next 20 or 30 or 40 years. Because once you, as you well know, once you have a detailed multilateral process, in our case over quite a number of years with many inputs and many discussions and many negotiations, then once agreement is reached, it's very difficult to change things. And so whatever comes out of that process has to be appropriate to maximize benefits, minimize risks, have sufficient flexibility given that technology will change, given that we don't exactly know what the activities will look like, but also be appropriate for a considerable period of time to ensure that whatever takes place is sustainable, is peaceful, is safe, is cooperative. So, you know, your questions are great because they highlight that this is complex. This is an issue about which humanity has to consider carefully, because once we really consider space in this way as an area, and that's the wrong word, but an area from which we can garner benefits through not only using it and exploring it, which are incredibly important, but as part of that usage to actually perhaps derive benefits from the resources of space. We already do that to a certain degree with orbits, of course, but now different types of resources. That's really important, but we have to ensure that we do that in a way that allows humanity to actually benefit, and that those benefits are, in a sense, for the broader community. And, you know, as I said, these are complex questions.
Thank you, Professor. So you made this point on the importance of having a multilateral and a multi-stakeholder dialogue. And since you're here in this podcast, I thought I would ask you this question on the working group on the legal aspects of space resource activities. I mean, to be very detailed about this working group, how did this journey of the space resource governance begin at the UN? Like, how are the different countries viewing this working group? And how does this working group plan to operate, and what are its plans and objectives and its mandates?
That's thank you for asking that and for your interest in the working group. So, as I said, the idea of exploiting resources of space is not new. Already, as I said, in the 70s, there was lots of discussion culminating in the finalization of the Moon Agreement. Then, for a whole range of reasons, the idea perhaps did not lie at the top of the focus of states. Other issues came to the fore. It's now been revitalized. But that's only a relatively recent revitalization. I've had the privilege of being a member of the Australian delegation to COPBOS for many years now, perhaps 13, 14 years. And I do remember a long time ago that when discussions were raised by one or two delegations talking about space exploitation of resources, there was quite a negative response in diplomatic language, but a negative response at COPBOS. As I mentioned earlier, when under the Obama administration, the United States passed its 2015 law that purported to grant those rights that I mentioned subject to the United States international obligations, that galvanized a discussion. The following year, there was a lot of discussion in COPBOS. Not all of it was supportive. There was quite a lot of criticism by member states about the fact that they perceived this was a unilateral action by one member state to reinterpret existing law. Now, I don't want to enter into that debate, but this galvanization made COPBOS realize that this is an issue that is here to stay, because now at least one significant space power has promoted it within its domestic framework, and then others have followed, as you know. So the way COPBOS works is, if in the end the member states, all decisions are made by consensus, by the way, so you can imagine how challenging that is and how difficult that makes the work I do, but it also makes it incredibly rewarding. If COPBOS by consensus decides that an issue is worthwhile discussing seriously, it will agree by consensus to have that issue as an agenda item. And it's quite an important step, because there are, of course, so many issues that could be talked about by the member states, but there's only limited time and resources to cover that. So they're quite judicious about what their agenda items are. But then in response to the 2015 US legislation, shortly thereafter, beginning in 2017, there was an agenda item looking at potential legal models for what was then called the exploration, exploitation and utilization of space resources. So it's an agenda item. Agenda item is, in a sense, a discussion topic. Then the member states can discuss exchange views, etc. When COPOS then wants to move from not just an important issue being a discussion item to what I always label, although it's a bit simplistic, to an action item, the member states can agree to establish a working group. So a working group is not three or four people. A working group is the 102 member states. But then they appoint a chair, and in our case, a chair and a vice chair. And in 2021, although there was already discussions about it a couple of years earlier and then COVID intervened, but in 2021, the member states agreed to establish this working group. Myself and a wonderful Polish diplomat, Ambassador Andrzej Misztal, were appointed. He as chair, myself as vice chair of that working group, and he's a pleasure to work with, and we work very well together. And then the member states, by consensus, had to agree what our working group's mandate was. And so we have a five-year mandate, which began in 2022, so will end in 2027. And the mandate is on the public record. If you go to the UN OOSA website, you can find our mandate and a whole lot of other information about our working group. But essentially, there are a number of steps we need to take in the 5 years. We need, within our mandate, to understand what's going on. So not just necessarily of a legal nature, but the current practices of a technical nature. What is real? What is proposed? What is possible? What is not possible? What is overhyped by industry? What, in a sense, is realistic? And so that's the first aspect of our, obviously we need to understand the questions before we can even begin to come up with any solutions or answers. So to that end, for example, there was an expert meeting held in Luxembourg just 2 weeks ago where member states nominated experts, non-legal experts, to talk about various aspects of space resource, potential space resource activity. Next week in Vienna, when the legal subcommittee of COPOS begins on the first day, we have an international conference, again convened by our working group, where, again, member states have nominated experts in various fields to talk about other potential issues that might be relevant. So that's part of the what is possible, what is real, what are the issues, what's going on, what might work in the future. Then, as part of our mandate, the member states need to examine the existing law that you and I talked about. What does the existing law have to say? As I mentioned and as you mentioned, the existing law has a lot to say already. And so the member states will work out exactly where they see the scope of the existing law. And then out of that, with an understanding of what might be possible, what sort of activities might take place, there'll be, in a sense, although these words aren't used in our mandate, a gap analysis. The existing law is important, but do we need more? Do we need more? And there'll be a discussion about if we need more, what sort of issues perhaps could do with further clarification on the governance level. And another thing that we need to do then, again, in this systematic approach, is the member states, the working group, the member states have to develop a set of initial recommended high-level principles that will, in a sense, be the culmination of all of these discussions about, high-level ideas that will guide any future activities. And then a further part of our mandate will be, okay, what's next? Where does this lead us? Those principles will be there, hopefully agreed by COPOS, perhaps sent on even to the General Assembly for endorsement, maybe not. That will depend on everything will depend on the member states. But then where to from here will be the last part of the mandate. And, of course, it's up to member states then, with the benefit of the knowledge of what has happened in these five and six years, as to what they would like to do next. if there are a set of principles, is that sufficient? Will the member states agree by consensus, perhaps, that they will be the foundation for something even more detailed? We don't know. It's not for me to speculate. The decisions are not mine to make. My job and Ambassador Michtal's job is to help guide the member states, but they lead the discussions, they make the decision. But you can see it's a systematic working through that will provide more and more clarification, more and more ideas about how any potential activities can and should be carried out to, as I keep on repeating, maximize the benefits and minimize the risks. So it's systematic. We meet every year at Legal Subcommittee. We've got, in addition to our international conference on Monday, we have five formal working group meetings. We will no doubt have a series of informal working group meetings over the period of the next 2 weeks. So we'll be very busy. 102 countries plus some permanent observers of COPOSC will be there. We have, during the year, also had meetings in COPOS plenary. That may or may not happen again this year. We have in the past had quite a number of intersessional meetings online. We had four in October, November, December and January leading up to where we are today. So it's extremely active. And, you know, Ambassador Michtal and I are conscious that states no doubt want to see that the work of this working group is moving forward in a way that is appropriate as far as they are concerned.
Thank you, Professor. So we talked about mechanisms and initiatives both within the UN and outside the UN to govern the use of space resources. Apart from the Artemis Accords and Artemis program, there's also China and Russia and a group of other countries that are part of the International Lunar Resource Station. Since you talked about the committee operating on consensus-based mechanism, how will you see this multilateralism play out in the, you know, governance of space resource in the future? Are you already seeing any kind of convergences or divergences of practices, initiatives and agendas from these countries?
Well, it's an interesting question. You mentioned specifically China and Russia there. They're very active members of COPOS, very supportive of the work. You look at the website of the working group, and I encourage anyone who is interested in this topic, there's a plethora of really rich inputs from countries, including both China and Russia and the United States, but many others as well. So they are very active members of COPOS. They are very constructive in their discussions in our working group, as you know, as are all the other states. But of course, you know, when you have 102 member states with 102 different histories, cultures, values, economies, alliances, perspectives, you're going to have different viewpoints. And that is, in a sense, the complexity, but also, in a sense, the beauty of the multilateral process. We hear those different perspectives and we try to find a common ground. It's really difficult. I'm not saying it's easy. And, of course, in these very difficult geopolitical times that we are in, it's even harder, of course. Nobody is denying that. But in the end, we have thus far at least found that we've been able to reach consensus on important issues, notwithstanding the geopolitical tensions that undoubtedly exist. Why? Because I think, and I can't speak for any member state, but my perception is that the member states realise that it's in their interests to see how these discussions pan out. Because, of course, the countries you mentioned and many others, like your country, India, for example, would like to be able to consider doing these activities in the future. And one would have thought, and I now put on my lawyer's hat, you would at least prefer, I would think, to have an idea about what the rules of the road are. And so I think countries probably realize that it's in their interest to move these discussions forward. But I can't deny exactly what you said. There are differences and tough discussions that take place in the formal meetings that we hold, in the informal meetings, and then, of course, on the fringes, you know, over coffee and whatever, there are lots of discussions going on. Because in the end, every decision has to be taken by consensus. That's part of the process. And consensus will involve every one of those 102 countries, be they major spacefaring nations, be they less developed spacefaring nations, or be they countries that are members of COPOS that don't even yet have any sovereign capability. They still have a voice. And we need to understand that, of course, that's important because of the legal nature of space, because also the consequences of action that is unacceptable will have, on everybody, large country, small country, less developed country, because we're all dependent on space. And therefore, we have to ensure that whatever activities are undertaken in any field, including this, are such that they don't impact adversely on that sustainable use of space for our generation, the next generation, and I would say for seven generations moving forward.
Thank you, Professor. So we talked about the United Nations Committee on Peaceful Use of Outer Space's working group, but I think the UN also has a plan to constitute an action team on lunar activities consultation under the UN. So how is this going to work in coordination with the working group, if you may have any thoughts on that?
Yes, and my thoughts are very, very high level in that this is still a proposal. Tejas, perhaps you could just mute yourself. Thank you. This is still a proposal. There will be discussion in the forthcoming legal subcommittee and at COPWAS for, as you say, this action team. I've read the proposal, but we don't exactly know what it will look like, who will be involved, how it will act. But I would say that any initiative that helps us more and more understand all of the, plethora of complex issues, technical, scientific, economic, political, cultural, indigenous, military, security, etc. Any initiative that helps for a greater understanding that ultimately then will feed back to the member states in the working group and in COPWAS is a positive. Again, the devil is in the detail always as to what this proposal might lead to. But I can't see it. I see it complementing the work of the working group because it will just add to our knowledge. And then that will be fed in. So any initiatives that are helpful, relevant, and inclusive, and that's, for me, important. Everybody has to have the opportunity to contribute. Because that process then will mean that in the end, whatever your end result is, has much more likelihood of adherence, compliance, and support if everybody has had the opportunity to contribute to the process. So, for example, if you and I, Tejas, were to set rules on any activity and we try to impose that on 30 of our friends and say, these are the rules, you have to act by it. That's very different from you and I and those 30 others having an ongoing process. We discuss, we all have inputs, we reach some end result. It may look very different to what each of us might have thought at the beginning, but it's an agreed result. If you compare those two examples, the other 30 are much, much more likely to adhere, support, and comply to that group proposal than they are if you and I could just try to impose on them. So I think process is a really important thing. Inclusiveness is a really important thing. And so as I understand it, this proposal is quite broad in terms of its inclusion and membership. For me, that's a positive, as long as, of course, it's not so broad that it's unworkable from a, just an administrative and logistical perspective. But as I say, any initiative that adds to our level of knowledge is, I think, useful.
Well, thank you, Professor. So we talked a lot about processes, but now let's come to the best practices, right? What are the certain best practices and principles that countries are currently envisaging to govern the use of these resources in a responsible and sustainable manner? Is there any practices that countries are currently looking to converge upon?
Well, yeah, firstly, the term best practices is not one that is favoured in the multilateral discussions, right? Because some argue that just connotes, you know, why one practice best, you know, it connotes a level of subjectivity. And so we talk, and you see in our mandate, when we talk about practices, we talk about current practices, not best practices. So that's what I talk about. I mean, yes, of course, and that's part of what the expert meeting, which was a preliminary meeting to our conference, and hopefully our conference on Monday afternoon, and that's, by the way, open on UNTV for everybody to watch. It's open to the world, and I encourage everybody to see that and also to follow COPOS proceedings more generally for the next 2 weeks. The working group, sadly, for the world, is won't be broadcast live on TV, but all the other activities of COPOS will be, including this conference. And these conferences are telling us, through the experts, what their current ideas and practices are, you know, in terms of the development of technology, in terms of the proposals, in terms of, from some, how to economize this, in terms of safety, in terms of environmental consequences. We're actually seeing around the world, given the interest, the high level of interest in these activities, an extraordinary array of government, public-private partnership, and private initiatives, technical, industrial, economic, scientific initiatives that are being developed, talked about undertake these sorts of activities. So, you know, I can't and I won't point you to any one country or company's activities as being better than others. But, you know, there are many different ideas being proposed. And that's interesting, but it also is part of the reason we need to understand what is real. Because, you know, there are a lot, for example, the idea of accessing water. There are many, many, many different organizations, countries, entities that are developing technology for completely different ways of doing that. And, you know, so one cannot say that one is better than the other or one is more likely than the other, perhaps. But we need to understand all of those. So the current practices are being developed. Of course, we've had sampling activities already. You know, I mentioned, of course, the 300 kilograms approximately of moon rock that the Apollo missions brought back. We've had sampling undertaken by other countries like China, your country, India, of course, and Japan and Russia. You know, many other countries are engaged in this or planning this. So we have already current practices about that, but those sampling activities, as incredible as they are, as, you know, innovative and exciting and scientific as they are not, in a sense, at the same level of some of the proposals about space resource activities, which are looking for some to gather resources of whatever type in much larger quantities in much different ways and perhaps for different purposes, including with the water to reprocess the water into oxygen, into fuel, you know, all of those things. So what's happening at the moment is an incredible leap forward, but we really are just at the end of the beginning in terms of practices. So that's where we are at the moment.
Okay. If I may, let us now turn our focus to India, and this will be my last question. India is a party to the Outer Space Treaty, the Liability Convention, the Return and Rescue Agreement, and the Registration Convention. It is also a signatory to the Moon Agreement. In 2023, India released its national space policy that encourages its non-governmental entities to engage in the commercial recovery and sale of space resources in accordance with applicable law, including its international obligations. Further, it also signed the Artemis Accords and successfully performed the Chandrayaan 3 mission and is planning to conduct more future missions to the moon. In this context, how do you see a country like India position itself in the coming years with regards to space resource governance? And how do you see India also contribute to this process on the objective of the working group? And what are the benefits for India to do so?
Thank you. And yes, again, if you, thank you. Yes, you're absolutely right. India, one, has made incredible steps in its innovation, in its spacefaring capabilities. You know, the Chandrayaan 3 mission, the whole world watched that successful landing. I watched it and was in awe of the achievement of your country there, you know, for a relatively small amount of money as well. Because, of course, we can't deny the fact that these are incredibly costly ventures. Anything in space is costly. But so India has made incredible leap forward. India is a really important player on the international geopolitical scene. It's a major country. It's now the most populous country in the world. It has such an incredibly important role to play in all aspects of international relations. When it comes to space, India is an incredibly important spacefaring nation. It's involved in cooperative activities with my country, Australia, but with many other countries in many different types of formats. At COPOS, India is a very active, important voice. One of 102, but it's an important voice, a respected voice, because for many reasons, but certainly your achievements in space, your country's achievements in space demand that respect. But also India is there to be a voice of reason. India is there to understand the different perspectives. You know, India has placed itself geopolitically to understand different perspectives. And I think that's incredibly important because we need to ensure that the debates are carried out in a manner where we hear all the perspectives, but we don't necessarily enter those discussions with a preconceived, you know, hardline view. You know, negotiation is what it is. You know, the idea that you listen, you learn, you don't necessarily agree with everything, but there might be things. And I think India has an incredibly important role to play. In my experience working with your delegation at COPWAS, both in COPWAS more broadly and then through our working group, India has been incredibly supportive and constructive. I think India can and should be active in this debate because India has a lot of its own experience to bring to the party. We can learn from your country's experience, as we can from many others. So the fact that India has developed its spacefaring capabilities in such a way. The benefits for India, of course, are obvious in my view. Clearly, India wants to be, it is, but it wants to be a respected member of the international community. A respected member that promotes the sustainable and peaceful uses of space. A respected country that is looking for cooperation, is looking to work together with others, is looking to develop science, is looking to develop the use and exploration of space for the benefits of many, including those less fortunate than some of us. Looking at equitable sharing, India is a party, as you mentioned, to four of the treaties. So it's shown itself to be, you know, absolutely cognizant of the understanding of law and the rule of law. You mentioned it's a signatory to the Moon Agreement. Even though it's not bound by the Moon Agreement, it's under obligations as a signatory not to do anything to defeat the object and purpose of the Moon Agreement under international law. That's its obligation under the Vienna Convention on the Law of Treaties. And so India is at the forefront of sitting there implementing, promoting, and considering and interpreting important principles of law. And I think it's a great benefit for India to be there at the table, to be active, to present its views, and its views will represent the views of your 1.3 billion people. What does India want to do in space? How does it see itself in space? How does it understand the benefits of peaceful uses of space? How does it understand the cooperation? Where, you know, what resources are important to devote to space? And how can we then filter back the benefits of that to the broader population, not just in your country, but then ultimately around the world? So I think there are great benefits for India. As I said, they're an active voice. They're always incredibly supportive and constructive. And I would like to see more of that. And I'm sure that your colleagues in the delegation are thinking very carefully about many of the complex issues that I've raised with you briefly today. There's no easy solution to all of this. We need to understand the perspectives of many. We need to have this inclusive process. We need to be transparent. We need to be open to different ideas. We need to understand that people will disagree and we need to find a common way forward. And your country and other countries, I think, have a really important role to play, not just as a major spacefaring nation itself, but also to help to be that bridge that make sure that we hear these views and then find a way forward. So I think there are great benefits for India, both in the tangible sense in being able to forward its own space activities, but I think in the broader sense as well as being one of those countries that can help bring us forward together on a multilateral basis.
Oh, thank you, Professor. Thank you very much. With that, we have reached the end of this podcast. Thank you very much. Considering the promises and challenges that space resource activities hold, we definitely understand the importance of governing it and look forward to following the international initiatives that are currently underway. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a new episode. To make sure you don't miss it, be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts from. To learn more about our research and team, you can visit us at carnegieindia.org. You can also find us on social media, on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Thank you for listening. See you next time.